And today we have several pieces of legislation that we'd like to hear from and talk about. I think, let's see, we had we have Senator Scogan here. Maybe we should start out with that. And I know one of your testifiers missing.
There's an accident, and he's behind it.
Okay.
And that's fine. I think I can just present it, and we don't have quorum yet, Mr. Chair, so we'll just start with some testimony.
And again, what we'll do is we'll go through the legislation we won't on these we'll the motion will be to lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the education finance bill. Other members have called too, and they're stuck in traffic. I'm sure the snow and stuff has caused some delays, so us rural legislators, you know,
I live by the St. Paul Central High School. I had no trouble getting here today.
Senator Scogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Before you today, and I guess I do have a testifier or some help on the legislation. And I'm looking for a number on it, but Senate File 3244, excuse me. The Minnesota Principals Academy is a staff development program for principals, which was initially authorized by the legislature over 4 years ago. The legislation authorized the Department of Education to collaborate with the University of Minnesota and establish a high-end program of training, education, and development for principals in Minnesota. This program incorporates curriculum from the National Institute for School Leadership. It is an initiative of the National Center on Education and the Economy. The coursework, developed over 6 years with major support from national foundations, and is being used in other states, including Massachusetts and Florida. The program was initially a Senate initiative. Subsequently, it garnered the support of the House and the Department of Education. And the last year, the funding went away, and the bill is hoping to continue funding. We're asking for reinstatement of the program and $400,000 to get the grant going. It does have support. I think our testifiers will talk to that. You know, Mr. Chair, Minnesota's Promise has received a lot of attention this session, and one of the essential elements is educator quality. And our goal is to try to implement Minnesota's Promise, and the Principals Academy, of course, would help to do that. When I had the opportunity to serve in the rural electric industry, we talked a lot about who leads or who teaches our leaders. And principals are asked to do many, many things in school districts, from minor details to major visioning. And we need principals that are well-trained and have all the tools to create outstanding schools. And principals are an important part of that. With me at the table today, Fred Storti, Executive Director of Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association, and also Julie Schweitzer, Director of Leadership Initiatives. And Mr. Chair, I'll turn the table over to them.
Thank you, Senator Scogan. And who would like to go first? If you can give your name for the record.
I'll go first. Thank you. Good morning, Senator Stumpf and members of the E-12 Education Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about the Principals Academy this morning.
Please give your name for the record.
My name is Fred Storti, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Academy. As Senator Scogan said, in 2005, the original legislation was passed for the Principals Academy. We were very excited about that. We've got the program started a year and a half ago. We have trained 48 principals from around the state of Minnesota in the initial training of the leadership program. They were very excited about the training they received. It was the National Institute for School Leadership curriculum was used. This was a 14-unit curriculum that focused on leadership, ethics, and the great thing about this program, not only focused on leadership, but instructional leadership in both literacy and numeracy, which was so important for our principals as instructional leaders. So this year we're training 20 principals around the state in the cohort, and in order to keep the momentum going, we really need this program to be funded in this train-the-trainer model. So I hope you'll consider, I know you have a lot of priorities this year, we would appreciate your support of this bill.
Mr. Sorti, the 48 was in 2005, and how long does the cohort go?
The cohort is about 28 to 30 days. And the first group, it went over about a 14-month period to continue complete the 28 to 30-day training. This year, with our 20 members, it's about a year-long, about 13-month program. And again, it's about 28 days of training.
Thank you. And I'm just looking at the brochure that was handed out. The cost is roughly about $8,000 to $10,000 per person. Is that still?
That's correct. In the original program, we expect that the costs will be less, and perhaps Julie Schweitzer would speak to that.
Senator Stumpf, if I could answer that, my name is Julie.
Sorry. Yep.
You're on. My name is Julie Schweitzer. I'm the Director of Leadership Initiatives at the College Readiness Consortium at the University. And our role has been really as the coordinator, the implementer of this. The bulk behind the program is the collaboration between the Elementary Principals Association, the Secondary Principals, and our school administrators. To your question, the cost was about that for our leadership team. And while the bill was authorized in 2007, the leadership team began in 2006 and went for about a year till August of 2007, and by then we had started our second cohort. The price is much less now. It is around $5,000 per person plus the cost of the facilitators. And so the initial investment of the state was in these, with a train-the-trainer model, the major investment is in that first group of the trainers, and then it is substantially more inexpensive and more efficient with each cohort that goes forward from there.
Do you have an idea what the cost of the facilitators comes to?
All told, we think we can do about 25 principals for around $140,000. And so you're spreading out the cost of those facilitators per person. It will get less expensive with time in that the license fee that we pay to NISL reduces with the more people we go through it. So it will go down as we get more people involved.
The legislation asks for $400,000 per year. Is the anticipation that you'll have more than the 20 members in 2009, or?
We would have as many cohorts as we have the funds to support. Our trainers are very excited and just anxious to get out there and do this more. We have a group of, we already, without funding, have a group of principals around Rochester, a group up, connected with the Northeast Higher Ed District that would love to go forward. There are quite a few around Duluth. The Moorhead-Crookston area is developing a lot of interest. We want to do this statewide, and we've had a statewide reach already, even in the 70 or so people that have gone through, but we'd like to hold cohorts near where the principals are so we don't have to deal with travel and the costs for the participants and to make it much more efficient and practical for them to participate.
So this is a statewide program?
Absolutely. We've had people from Moorhead, Jackson County, Ely, Duluth, and most points in between.
I don't know where I heard this, but I had heard that most of the participants were basically from the metropolitan area, but maybe I'm wrong.
The initial cohorts that we held were located in the metropolitan area, but in our trainers group, again, we had a woman driving down from Moorhead, Ely, The places I've named: Jackson County, Pine Island, Wilmer, Matamidi, St. Cloud. They've been coming long distances. In your mail back in your offices, you'll find a DVD with a short video that's mostly the participants talking about their experiences. And Mary Jo Schmid, an elementary principal from Moorhead, says it was the best 4 hours in either direction. She had to go 4 hours each trip, best 4 hours she ever spent. So it has been statewide, but that's not reasonable to expect people to drive that. So the next cohorts, the plan is to have it out in locations where they won't have to do what Mary Jo so willingly did for 25, 28 days.
I'm sure Senator Scogin is very interested in touching all the corners of the state, especially those that are more remote. So, okay. Is when you do your selecting of cohorts, is it just how do you get a geographic cross section, you know, so that you do have, you know, your all the corners are touched? I assume that it's right now it's like whoever can make the effort and has the funds to and time to do it. Is there some more systematic way that the program could be made available to principals across the state?
We think the primary way to do that is to hold it in locations across the state. And when we recruited for the current cohort, we thought we would have continuing funding and said we were starting one in the metropolitan area, one in Duluth, and one we were looking at Wilmer at the time. And we had people interested in those different locations. When we were only able to do the one cohort, some from those locations chose to come to the metropolitan area. We're holding it at the Department of Education at the moment. And others said, I'm going to cross my fingers and hope you've got the Duluth or the Wilmer or the other location and do that next. So we have been attentive to geography, but we think in the future the primary way is to hold it in Moorhead and then the people or Marshall or, you know, hold it in regional locations and let people choose whether what they want to do is the local one or on occasion because it's a chance to visit your child who lives in another part of the state. You know, they may choose somewhere else, but it's holding it in those locations that will reach all corners of the state.
And is the request, the $400,000 request, does that cover those other locations?
That would cover holding cohorts in several locations across the state. Now, we couldn't do everybody in 2 years, but with an ongoing effort, we would hold them in different places so that we could reach across the state.
Okay, I think it would be helpful to the legislature if there was some kind of a report back as to like where the cohorts were held, and then also like those funds actually were expended. Is that
We'd
right?
certainly be happy to do that.
We can do that, sure.
Oh, okay.
You need a motion?
No, I think we can ask Senate staff to maybe just work up some language that would include those. So. All right, any other questions, Senator Wicker?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, it's a great vision and you know the sobering reality right now of the deficit, and it's anguishing to hear the great ideas, the potential to help inspire so many principals. One question. It says in the charge that the group also includes other school leaders besides principals, and how many non-principals would attend the institute or the academy?
In the current group of 24, Senator Wicker, there are three charter school principals or charter school leaders. They don't use the word principal, and that's what we've been referring to. There are 21 their principals, or there are a couple of people that have taken leadership roles in their districts in providing professional development for principals. That change has occurred while they've been in the Principals Academy. But we're trying to make sure we're inclusive of charter school leaders as well. The research shows us that you can't have a high-performing school without a high-performing principal, and that's the reason behind this.
Senator Bonham, or Senator Weir? Or Senator, did you have another question? Senator
not
Weir?
For now. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Bonham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scogin, I'm glad you brought this forward because I know the principals were disappointed that we didn't fund this last year, and so I think it is very important that we find some way to keep this going forward because it is the principals who are making the difference on the ground, and they're at the front lines, and they have the biggest chance of impacting our students. Having said all that, I'm wondering if you could talk about what you're getting currently from the university. I understand that they provide some support to this program, so I'm just looking at, is there some way to have a partnership in bad times where if we couldn't come through with as much money, you still have that chance?
Well, first of all, the... thank you. It's really a collaboration between the Department of Ed and the University of Minnesota and the Principals Associations and also the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, the three administrative groups, named, of course, in the legislation of the department and the university. And Julie can speak maybe a little bit more to that funding source from the university.
And so far, thank you, Senator Stemp. So far, the contribution has been my time and that of Kent Pakel, the executive director, which, if I add it up, would be a significant percentage of my time over the last year. So while it and we are funding the food for, because these are all-day sessions, we are funding the lunches for the group throughout the 27 or so days this year as a cash contribution. And, of course, we have some principals that are driving significant distances and are staying overnight. And in some cases, their school districts are funding that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonham.
So it sounds like you're not really getting very much money from the university for this program.
Well, we're getting about a quarter of my salary and another 10 or 15,000. Well, $10,000 for the meals and other contributions.
Thank you.
I have them written down here, Senator Rummel and then Senator Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to speak in support of this bill and this funding. A few years ago in my other life, I was commissioned to do a peer-reviewed study on the mathematics and instruction in our schools. And it turned out in this study that the quality and the preparation of the principal was key in the success of any of the school initiatives for reform. And so I think that investing in the Principal Academy is one way to magnify and multiply our dollars.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Rummel. Senator Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I feel badly that I didn't advocate for this more last year. I think some, perhaps there are others that just, it, not that it slipped through the crack, but it just wasn't there on the front burner. And so I apologize that I didn't see this. But the other thing I'd like to maybe present as an opportunity to this committee is that with funds being short, might we look at this as the state provides a matching grant? And because I have heard from, again, some people in like our business community who have visited some of our very successful schools, they always comment that at the helm is always this very creative principal who is leading the charge. And so perhaps when we've looked at other grants, I know the STEM grants with 3M and the Science Museum, where, you know, the state presented, you know, we'll put in this much. If we can find matching funds from the private sector, it may be a way to leverage dollars and to ensure that this continues, because I think the business community understands that our principals are sort of the CEOs of these small, you know, groups, and how can they provide leadership? Also, how can our business community be involved in this? Because I think that that creates, again, a stronger partnership between education. So perhaps that may be something just to put out there as an option as we look at, you know, at the budget and wanting to obviously fund all these fabulous programs, but we don't have the resources that we wish we had. So I just put that as
a
suggestion.
Thank you, Senator Salzman. Mr. Aronson made it through the traffic. Do the school administrators feel flush enough to come up with some matching grant money?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think that we've had some discussion about that, and that we're very our memberships are very excited about this program. It's been very, very successful, and we've talked to Senator Salzman about this discussion that she just raised. The U has been, as Ms. Weiss was telling you, basically subsidizing this program as we try to keep it alive. So we're going to do whatever we can, and obviously, as Senator Weaver pointed out, we're aware of the financial stuff with everyone else. So we're going to do whatever we can to try to keep this alive, and certainly to try to bridge it into the next budget cycle if we're unable to have a bill this year. I wanted to say, too, I apologize for being late, but we really thank Senator Scogin for carrying this initiative for us, and it's an important initiative to us.
Mr. Aronson, was that a yes or a no on the...
I'm a lawyer, Mr. Chairman. The question is, what do you want it to be?
Mr. Chair, I think you'd be a good politician, too.
I think that there's the potential to do that and explore other sources as well. As we said in the House, that we were prepared to look in every couch cushion available to find the nickels and dimes to keep this alive.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Clark.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I heard a yes in there because since you said it could be whatever we want, and as an attorney, I often hear what I want to hear as well. I just want to make sure we've got several things that are up today that I would say are kind of casualties of the very end of session. And while you can't always talk about those things, this is a really good project, and it really should have gotten done. And I think that people in the Senate really do support it. I think people in the House support it, but sometimes odd things happen. Mm-hmm. And if there's a way that we can keep moving forward on this and doing the good things that you're doing, you know, as well as the Humanities Center, as well as the History Center, I think that all of these are small amounts that you probably were leaving at the end of the day going, what the heck is going on? And just hopefully we're going to be able to be partnering with you as we move forward. And this is obviously a challenging year, but we'll keep working together.
Hey, Senator Weaver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifiers, I'm not necessarily advocating this, but what about the option if this was linked to QComp?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weaver, in terms of looking for shifting of revenues that already exist in the system and... because there are some unspent, we discussed this yesterday with a legislative lobbying group. There are some unspent revenues in QComp. I think that the department and the governor's plan is to try to apply that to some of the deficit. I hope that's not me. That would be an excellent source to do this because there is some unspent money in the QComp account. I know that that's getting applied towards the budget shortfall. But again, Mr. Nauman, I'm sure correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think it's like $40 million. Is that what we discussed yesterday, Senator?
I guess it'll depend as to which schools are approved before that, you know, the amount is recorded. Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I was visiting with the Department of Finance on an unrelated topic. Was the question how much is unspent in the QComp program at this point?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on what point in time you pick and what approvals the department is likely to make in the future, but there's about $24 million of aid that is unallocated to school districts at this point. And that's a comparable number to the $32 million or so that was available last year. And members will remember that this committee recaptured and spent some of that money last year. Members will also recall that in the both November and February forecast, some of that money for fiscal year 08 that this committee reallocated was reabsorbed into the forecast because it was unspent.
Right.
There's also levy savings of about $9 million.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wicker, I think you've given us something to think about, though. I mean, QComp is, as we were discussing, based around staff development, is a big part of that, and this that may be an answer.
Okay. Any other questions that members have? It seems like there's Mr. Sardi.
Yes, if I could just reinforce that point. You know, QComp is to a teacher's professional development. Principals really are an important part of making that happen, but they really weren't included in terms of the compensation part of professional development. So conceptually, it certainly is a great idea.
Just for my own clarification, the cohort is formed. And then I believe Ms. Schweitzer, you mentioned there's training of the trainers, is it? Or training, was there another group besides the cohort coming in and let's say the faculty that might train the cohort? Or just give us a very quick explanation of what happens.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Stumpf. We started out with 48 school leaders that we call our leadership team, and they were trained by national experts from educational as well as business, military, multiple fields. They are now the trainers for the other Minnesota principals. So the 24 people who are principals who are in our current cohort are being trained by that first group of 48. That's why the investment is larger at the beginning but becomes less and less and really pays for itself over time.
Okay. So that original cohort really becomes the kind of the faculty or the trainers.
Exactly.
So how are they giving up their time to continue the program, or are they I can see the advantage of it all over the state because it would be hard to, if you had a cohort in Duluth, I mean, would you have, if you had just trained people in the metropolitan area, all of them would have to go back up there. Mm-hmm. So you probably want to get some trained people up there, too.
And that's why. Yes, Senator Stumpf, you're exactly right. And that's why our first cohort was very comprehensively from across the state. The Moorhead, Ely, Duluth, in the south, Jackson, you know, Wilmer, in the center, from all those locations, because they are giving up their time for this cohort. They are all expected to do at least one 2-day training, and they spend a good 2-plus days preparing for that training on their own for free as their payback for being part of that leadership team. We can't expect them to do that forever, so at some point we need to start paying them a reasonable daily rate. But when we hold a cohort in the north, whether it's Moorhead, Ely, Duluth, Chisholm, wherever, we would probably primarily have northern facilitators, but we would have others who would travel.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions that members have? Senator Scogin, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 3244 be recommended to pass and be held for possible inclusion in the omnibus E-12 budget bill.
On Senator Scogin's motion, and we didn't have any amendments, but we will have some language when this comes back up for that report.
On the report?
Yeah, sure. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you,
Mr.
Very
Chair.
Much.
Thank you, committee.
Thank you very much.
Information.
Thank you.
Senator Rummel, I'd like to take the Senate file 2669. That's our childhood screening.
Do you want to take that first?
Sure.
Oh.
Members, there is a fiscal note on this one, and you'll find it in your packet. It's Senate File 2669, and this is the early childhood screening proposal. Senator Rummel.
Money for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. Last year I presented this bill, and it was a bill that made really good sense to me in light of all the work we were doing on special education. Basically, what this bill asks us to do is to continue our early screening of children and to bring it down to an earlier age. What we find is that the sooner we can identify any learning obstacles that children might have, we can find the correct interventions for those obstacles and make sure that the children are ready to start school on a par with their other peers. So the bill adjusts the fee for screening, and I'll let the testifiers talk to you about that. I do want to tell you that when I was doing some interim work this fall, I was up in Forest Lake and in an early childhood family education center, and there was a number of children that had been identified very early with various obstacles that got in the way of what their potential could be. And by the time those children got to kindergarten, they were on a par with their peers. It was very impressive that the sooner we identify what's going on, the sooner we can take care of the problem. And so without much more explanation, I'm going to turn this over to my witnesses.
Okay, thank you, Senator Rummel. If you could give your name for the record. And
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Tammy Dunrood. I'm from the Forest Lake Family Center, Forest Lake Area School District 831. The Forest Lake Family Center has four main programs: early childhood family education, school readiness, family learning, and early childhood screening. And I've been the coordinator of our early childhood screening program for the past 9 years. And today I just hope to share some both state and local district information with you about early childhood screening.
Please go ahead.
Just an overview of early childhood screening. It is such a beneficial program to our state's youngest children, just as Senator Rummel was just sharing. It is designed to be an early detection process for young children so that we can see if there's any lags in the areas of development, learning, growth, those kinds of things. If factors are detected in children, they are then referred for further assessment. And the screening is often the very first experience that families have with a school district. So we're able to share just great information with them about services such as early childhood special education. Some of them come with no insurance, so we're able to talk about Minnesota Care, resources for eye care, health care. We also work collaboratively with Head Start and WIC. So I think are really just a good comprehensive referral network for families, so they don't have to go to multiple locations to get the information that they need. And early identification, as I'm sure you all know, really does have long-term cost benefits, but it does help also a child be successful in their later years at school. And without early intervention, many students that are identified at screening with one or more risk factors do tend to lag behind their peers once they do hit the K-12 system. It is a mandated program so that if a child is attending a public school in Minnesota, they must be screened before school entry. And the program targets children ages 3 and 4 years old. And we did start now the new MARS system that was mandated so that when students come to screening, they are given a student identification number. So as they move from district to district throughout the state, it is easier to track their information. We also this year started a screen for social-emotional factors, so that has been added as well. And then we are required to do a yearly report to the Minnesota Department of Education. Early identification of children is really optimal, but if you've ever screened a three-year-old, it is very time-intensive, and it does tend to be cost-intensive as well. A little bit about the funding history of the program. since I started in 1998, it was $40 per child, no matter the age. And then in 2005 and 2006, an incentive was put into place to screen younger children. So the reimbursement went up for three-year-olds at $50 and four-year-olds at $40 and five-year-olds at $30. But it is an underfunded mandate, and I just wanted to share some statistics with the committee, if I may. These are based on the 2007 annual report that districts are required to report to Minnesota Department of Education, as well as the MARS data. So in 2006 and 2007, in the state of Minnesota, 59,752 children were screened. And the reported cost to do that was $4,287,656. Or the average cost, if you break that out, was $71.76 per child. Just to give you 1 year back from that, the average cost was $65.69 per child. So as the more mandates are required, the more the cost goes up per child. Just wanted to share a little bit about my own district in Forest Lake in terms of our screening program. Last year we screened 553 children. We try to set up days and times that are convenient. We have a really high working parent population in Forest Lake that do commute, so we do offer a lot of evening appointments for families. Majority of positive feedback from parents in our program, they tell us that we have an excellent staff, that we're informative, we're friendly, we're helpful. The staffing that we use comes from a variety of places: early childhood special education, speech clinicians, early childhood teachers, and then we have no administrative costs that are built in, even though our community education director, our ECFE coordinator, myself, our clerical, are all doing that budgeting, that staffing, that supervising, all of those things that go with administrative duties of a program. And the staff members that screen are not overpaid either. In fact, most of them are working at a rate that is below their regular salary. So in Forest Lake last year, we screened 265 three-year-olds. So at $50 a child, that was $13,250. We screened 177 four-year-olds, and at the $40 reimbursement rate, that was $7,080. And we screened 86 five-year-olds, and at the $30 reimbursement rate, that was $2,580. So last year, our total reimbursement in Forest Lake was $22,910, which is a cost reimbursement about $41.43 per child. Now, the actual cost of screening children in our district last year was well over $27,000, or over $50 per child to screen. So we had a deficit, and that deficit for us comes from multiple places in Forest Lake. It can come from the Community Ed Fund, ECFE, School Readiness Funds. We all try to help with that deficit. But then the local challenge comes in that cuts into our ability with those programs to provide more and better services that we're providing to the screening deficit. So in closing, early childhood screening is a very solid, important program. I believe in this program. This is a program that's near and dear to my heart because it definitely benefits young children. I could tell you story after story of successes that we've heard from parents. And the local districts, I think, are providing early childhood screening very well. We're doing it conveniently, efficiently, frugally. But we have a growing deficit every year that we're facing. And so I would encourage you to support the Senate File 2669 today. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Dunrood. What was the – well, you did give us the average. It was 71.76, and that was 2006. So, okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark?
I was a little confused about that, too, because you said the 71.76, but then I thought you said the average was 65, but you all are able to do it at 50. So
do it at 50.
If you could talk a little bit more about how you're doing it at 50, because what we're trying to accomplish two things. One is certainly making sure that you are able to have adequate resources to do this, but the other is, frankly, we want to incentive it to do it as early as possible. And so, frankly, I'm a little concerned about there only being $5 different between 3 and 4. I actually put a bigger gap there and I'll ask a follow-up question about that. But can you talk a little bit more about how you do it at 50 and what might that mean for others in terms of looking at your kinds of practices?
Well, this year, the $50 – can I speak?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, this year our $50 will go way up. Forest Lake School District is becoming a lot more diverse, so I am spending a lot more on interpreters this year. In fact, at the end of the month, we're hosting an ESL screening where it's a night where we're providing both Spanish and Hmong interpreters and transportation. So I'm going to see my costs this year becoming much closer to that $70 per child level, just because of the way our district is changing and we're needing to add more services to screening.
Senator Clark.
Well, so I guess a couple of things. I mean, that interpretation broadly is something that we need to keep thinking about in terms of districts and services, because it is critically important, and so that conversation probably is a longer one that we should have on another day. But I guess as we're moving forward, and I strongly support this, I would hope that we could look at having more of an incentive on the earlier end, and then I was working on some language to be bringing back to you all anyways, and maybe we could, if we're able to, and I know financially we may not be able to do this, but if we're able to move forward on this, that we encourage everybody who's doing early childhood-related programs to be making sure they're letting parents know about the screening and that it's available at age 3, because if we can get more kids screened at that age, I know Senator Wieger is interested in the MARS numbers, among other things. We, right now, when we get to kindergarten and are doing the assessment, we don't really have a good clue about where kids have been earlier on, and parents really could use that information. We also are making some assumptions about what programs or strategies have been used with the kids during that time without really having any baseline information. And so when we've been kicking around ideas, part of the thought is, well, instead of coming up with a whole nother approach, let's figure out how we can make sure that districts are able to do it earlier and parents who would like to would have the information so we can get moving. So I guess that's two things, Senator Rummel, as we're moving on. Obviously, I strongly support what you're trying to do here.
Mr. Dunner, does the school district send out a card or an invitation based on the school census?
Absolutely.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we do. We work closely with our census department, and we get the lists of children that are 3 years old that they have in the district. Oftentimes families move in that, you know, we sometimes beat the census department to that because we have programs that are like our family literacy program, which is our ESL program, that are not on the census yet, so we do help them with that. But they get a welcome letter from us from the district, saying that their child is 3 years old. We actually screened the first time at 3 years, 6 months. And then we welcome them to the district and encourage them to sign up for an appointment time.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, I too support this bill, and I'm carrying a bill about kindergarten screening with Senator Michelle as part of the work we've done for the Early Childhood Subcommittee. And one of the things we've been talking about, to echo Senator Clark's comments, is how can we tell that what we're doing in early childhood is making a difference? Because once our young people are in school, we have ways to measure growth. And it seems to me if we can find a collaborative way to take this data and then compare it to our kindergarten readiness assessment, we can begin to build a model of, is what we're doing in early childhood education working, and to establish that baseline data and actually then begin to have some accountability measures in the early childhood area. So I really appreciate that.
Okay. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Rummel, I wanted to kind of repeat what Senator Bonham and Senator Clark just said, but in terms of figuring out how do we develop best practices, I think this is one perfect example of how some districts are right now working on figuring out best practices for screening, for early childhood screening. And many districts are concerned about your concern, which is the number of children that are coming to the districts that speak different languages, that have different abilities. And part of what is happening, I believe, what I've learned through the assessment that we did for our achievement gap proposal, is that districts are not connecting with one another about best practices. So I'm glad that you are taking care of the cost issue, but I think that the next step is really to figure out how we use these dollars more effectively, because one of the challenges that we have with young kids is that many districts are, in the Minneapolis School District, for instance, we're talking about the need to hire people who speak the language of the child and understand the child, because working with interpreters is not very good if you don't have early childhood background. So it is. This is a very challenging issue, and so the cost will go up as you talk about having two practitioners, an early childhood expert and a person who speaks the language. But ideally, what we have, what we're thinking that we need to have, is an early childhood professional that speaks the language of the child or that knows the culture of the child. And some of the reservations are working on this model very well, and I think that we need to ask them to help us with this process.
Hey, why don't we go ahead and listen to?
Yes, we have with
finish
us
finish the testimony, and
we have with us from the School Nurses Association, Liz Zeno. Is that right?
Yeah. Please give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Liz Zeno. I'm a school nurse working in Minneapolis Public Schools, but I'm here on behalf of the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota.
I'm sorry, could you just pull that microphone just a little bit closer? Thank you.
I really appreciate what Senator Torres Ray just said, because that certainly is true for our experience in Minneapolis, that one of the nice things about this program, the early childhood screening, is that each school district figures out for themselves what combination of people is right for doing this screening. And so in school districts where the population is fairly straightforward, they can do it at a lower cost. In Minneapolis, where we have a lot of immigrant families and a lot of non-English speaking families, we do believe in the program and have invested a lot more money in making sure that we have native language speakers that are assessing the children, because you can't really assess how a child is doing in their language development unless you know their language. And it's very different having native speakers than even folks that have learned it in school. So the costs from one district to another vary a lot. Yep. Depending on their population. In Minneapolis this past year, the total costs of the program were about $400,000, and the reimbursement for that was $127,000. So you can see that there's a large gap there, and that extra money in large part came out of the general fund. So that's money that's in competition with classroom programs. Now, last year the Senate did approve the funding, and it was in the omnibus bill, and so we thank you for that and hope that you will support that again, because we do feel it's a very important program, and that the investment in that learning readiness is really money very well spent. It really helps families connect with the educational system. And when we're screening children, about 5% of the children are identified as having a disability that requires special education services. But there are many, many more children than that that are growing up in families that just don't have a rich educational environment. They might not have books in the household. They aren't telling stories, maybe, and other things that are things that we know help children be ready for school. And so by screening the kids early and getting them into early childhood family education and other programs, we can help with that learning readiness. And the cost of the program really isn't just the screening, because it doesn't do any good to do the screening if you don't have programs and the ability to follow up and the translators and things like that. I also wanted to address what people have asked about the outreach. That in Minneapolis, our population is very mobile, and so it's a different kind of outreach to reach those families. And many families, I think, still have the idea that the early childhood screening is sort of a test they have to pass before their child goes to kindergarten. So they want to wait as late as possible before having their child go through that test, whereas we think of it differently. We want them in as early as possible so that we can intervene with those families. So that takes a lot of outreach to get that message across to families and convince them to come in. So I think it's a very, very valuable program, but it is underfunded, and we hope that you will support us in increasing the funding.
Okay, thank you. Do you, is it Ms. Zane? Zeno?
Liz. Zeno.
Zeno. Zeno. Do you think that's a somewhat of an average, the 5% of those that are screened have some disability, or
is that what you think?
Maybe I should be asking Ms. Dunrud.
Mr. Chair, that was numbers that I got from my colleague in St. Paul, but
okay.
By their numbers it's about 5%.
Right. And from your testimony, it would seem that when you look at the legislation, there might be of some benefit to have a little greater disparity between the or not disparity, but a larger number for that first screening at age 3. It seems like there's only $5 difference between age 3 and age 4, and then $5 difference between age 4 and age 5, whereas before there was, well, I guess it was $10, but I mean, is there a benefit to having more of an incentive for that first screening?
Mr. Chair, I think the statewide average, if you look at the money, it's just over $71 per child screened, but as Tammy had said, it takes a lot more time to screen a 3-year-old than it does to okay. screen a 5-year-old. We would love to have more 3-year-olds coming in and getting screened. We'd love to have more funding there. But like I said, the parents, I think, don't yet understand the concept of screening their child at 3. So there's a lot more 5-year-olds that we're screening when they get that letter from the school that says you have to have this before you start kindergarten. So I hate to give up the 5-year-old funding for the 3-year-olds because that's more who we're seeing. But
okay. Well, I think Senator Clark was talking about that too. All right. Any other questions? Senator Therese Wright.
Mr. Chair and members, I think this is really a very important issue, and I would like to encourage the members to really review what Senator Bonoff just said, because I think we really need to work with both Senator Bonoff and Senator Rommel, because the issue around funding and really being more responsible about how we do this, about this practice, is very important. It is both. We need the funding to do it, but we also need to really have a program in place that is more effective. So it's kind of I think that one cannot be done without the other. Just putting the funding in place and not having really some policies to support a strong system, a sound system of developmental screening is important. So I hope that we are able to really do both this year, because I think it's critical.
Senator Salzman?
Yes. And on that same point, Mr. Chair, I sit on the Transportation Committee. And not to equate children with our bridges, but we had pages and pages of inspections that had been done, which I would equate to the fact that we do screening. And yet the legislative auditor's report came back and said, but we didn't really always use that information to make the repairs, that's where we fell behind. So I think that if we invest significant dollars, which do we have significant dollars, and we don't have the programs in place, then, you know, what are we really doing with these screening dollars, and how do we involve parents in that? Are there public service announcements that are going to, I mean, I understand letters, but what else are we doing to do outreach to make sure the parents understand why this is so important? So I get, you know, children are not bridges, but when you sit on these two committees, you see a lot of things that are very similar in terms of getting to things earlier.
Okay. Members, if you want some good reading on the subject, Chapter 121A.17 has kind of the language built behind the whole process of screening. And as I was reading this, because I was trying to figure out in my mind, you know, what when we talk about screening, what is it? Is it testing? Is it, you know, are we checking how well the child can read? And for the most part, it is not. It's more or less, is that child at a level where they should be for that age? And I think it was last year in Senator Wigger's committee, we spent a lot of time. I mean, you don't want to get into this concept of testing I mean, we went through a lot of debate on this whole thing. But I think to a large extent, when you read this chapter, you find out that there are a lot of incentives to try to help these children so that they, if they have a disability, if they have to find out where the resources are, I think Ms. Dunrood was mentioning, get help early. And that means that then they can move right into the mainstream as they get into prepare for school. So, Senator Saltzman.
So just another thought is that we've also heard about how, you know, family physicians and pediatricians, what is their role in this? And if children are going for well-child checkups, are we duplicating effort? I mean, are we? I'm not saying that we are, but how do we work with them? And not to push this into Senator Berglund's committee, but, you know, I guess I ask, where are we with that? Because we've also heard initiatives of where family physicians and pediatricians are trying to support, like, our reading efforts and literacy, you know, and impressing upon parents how important that is. So where does the medical community fit with this so that, again, we don't have silos, but that we're working together and sharing information? I'm not sure what the answer to that is, where we're at with that.
Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saltzman, you're making that case for that early childhood office. That's mm-hmm. where we can actually get That's people right. coordinating with each other and thinking broadly. I think, you know, one of the things we're trying to do, and Senator Torres-Ray, you brought up some really good points. I mean, and I just would like to reinforce the notion that we need to have more people who really have developmental expertise, who also are speaking the language of the families who are coming in, because it is totally different to use an interpreter than to have, you know, the attempt to have that relationship as you're screening that child. So that's important as school districts are moving along, but it's a real challenge with so many languages. But I was thinking also about, in some ways, we're trying to find those efficiencies and find the ways that we can really get the kind of information parents need, and then also what's going to help us in the long run. And we believe we've got some good services out there, but we don't entirely know. And frankly, we haven't necessarily given people the resources that they need to do the kind of level of developmentally appropriate teaching that maybe we're all looking at now. So I do think if we can't expect this tool to be everything, but if we can get more kids screened at 3 and give parents not just doing the flags on who may have special needs, you know, and if you look at Head Start, 25% of all kids in Head Start in greater Minnesota have special needs. If we're able to start having the information that can come back up then through the school system, then we've got a better notion of what's happening. But I would also caution us that as we move along, we are also going to need to look, and this is true in child care as well, if family child care providers want to be thinking about how to do this too, and it makes it more complicated for all of us, is how are we doing developmentally appropriate assessments during the time? Again, one of the things the feds at first, Head Start kind of freaked out about this, and understandably, without additional money, they started requiring them to do 3 assessments a year in the classroom just about where the kid's at. And some of it was not great. At first, they were looking at a tool that included things like the words savanna. Not many 3- and 4-year-olds know what a savanna is. I hate to say it, a lot of adults probably don't know what it is either.
But we need things that are appropriate, but then we also need to be thinking about how are we enhancing our professional development and the connections to other resources so that as people that are working with our children are getting information that says, well, maybe there's some things they could work on here or here, is what are those best strategies? And so as we've been kind of putting all those pieces together, the closing the achievement gap, the early literacy, developmentally appropriate screening and strategies, let's figure out how we can build on these, but let's also then not make it so that, okay, we did this at age three, and gee, nothing worked between three and five because nobody actually worked on it in between. But I think, you know, if we can, it makes sense a squirmy three-year-old's going to take a little bit more time than a not-quite-so-squirmy five-year-old, but if we can help you get to the point through outreach and other things, that can make a huge difference in what we're all trying to do, and hopefully save us money in the long run.
Thank you. I think we'll move on, and
thank you for your tolerance, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rummel?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 2669 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible consideration in the finance bill, education finance bill.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify on that? This was part of our package last year as well.
Yeah.
And so, right, if not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Rummel. And we're going to take Senator Dahl, who's here, and deal with Senate File 3436. It's kind of many of these programs members have seen before because they have been part of a funding package that we had passed in the Senate before, but one of the reasons I guess we're here looking at these again is that they were part of a program called Best Practices, which was a funding kind of category that funded a number of these programs, and somehow last year that was lost in the final days of the legislative session. So we're looking at them again. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. I think this is the first time I've been before your committee, so I'm
welcome.
Looking forward to this, and I'm glad you gave me one that's already been looked at before, so I have a lot of questions. I think this is a good year, though, to look at this particular bill as we're moving into our sesquicentennial and talking about history. This is kind of the focus of this bill. I'm sure you all know that in 2004, the legislature created that new graduation standards for social studies to include history, and you know, those standards are supposed to include content standards as well as skills standards. Now, as schools and teachers are learning how to adapt to these new standards, it's important that we provide professional development support to give them the confidence and the competence to implement these new requirements into their curriculum. And that's really the focus and the thrust behind this particular program. It is an appropriation for $200,000, and it's in conjunction with the Minnesota Historical Society. So to really kind of dig into the details, I guess, of this, I'm going to turn this over, if I may, to Tim Hoagland of the Minnesota Historical Society.
Hey, thank you, Senator Dahl. Is it Mr. Hoagland?
Hoagland, correct.
Okay. Please give your name for the record.
Okay, my name is Tim Hoagland, and I'm the head of education outreach programs at the Minnesota Historical Society.
Thank you. Go ahead.
And as the chair mentioned, this and Senator Dahl as well, the Historical Society has been one of the cornerstone educational institutions in the state since before statehood. But our role in K-12 education has shifted to some degree in the past few years because of the development of the new social studies standards, and also the way the society is working on its education programs in general. Traditionally, the Historical Society, like a lot of cultural organizations, was waiting for kids to come to us via field trips to our historic sites and museums. But as my work at the society has evolved over the past 17 years, what we've seen is more outreach, going out to work directly with schools to do more professional development for teachers, and those things were amplified by the development of the state standards. And the society was brought in as a consultant to the standards development process, and out of that, there were some very specific niches within the standards that the society has a particular set of expertise. Obviously, Minnesota history, which for the first time was directly required by social studies in education standards in the state. Before, it had been taught by tradition. Now it is in the standards themselves. The other things that we've been working on are trying to increase the place of Minnesota history in the teaching of American history. It seems kind of obvious to think about it that way, but a lot of teachers sometimes feel that state history exists in its little fishbowl and doesn't really represent the larger trends of American history. And so we've had great success recently to work with high schools to use parts of our collections, for example, when they're talking about the Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg, those kinds of things, to use Minnesota examples to increase the relevance of that instruction. Because the society has a long relationship with the American Indian nations of Minnesota, and our historic sites are representative of both Dakota and Ojibwe history and culture, we have a strong relationship with teaching those standards. And also through programs like the National History Day program, where students are asked to do in-depth historical research and presentations, the society is working actively throughout the state to really help teachers help their students become engaged in the practice of being a historian. And so as we go forward, we've got a lot of tools that are out in the schools, like the Northern Lights textbook that's circulating for the committee members, that we really have been able to see over the past 3, 4, 5 years a lot of catalytic partnerships that the society has been able to maintain with the University of Minnesota, the Minscu campuses, the service cooperatives throughout the state. And we've been able to have our professional development staff actually work in partnership for federal grants that require school districts and local education agencies to partner with a historical organization and to achieve those grants. And that's resulted in about $7 million of federal dollars coming into the state of Minnesota. Some of the school districts and service co-ops include the Northwest Service Co-op, Minneapolis Public Schools, St. Paul Public Schools, Northfield, have been beneficiaries of grants that have come in through those partnerships. And we're really working to try and figure out how are we going to evaluate the effectiveness of the programs that we're working, not only with teachers, but getting down to seeing what those impacts are on the quality of instruction and the outcomes for students.
One of the challenges, I think, for any program that, whether it's teacher development or in the case that you're trying to present here, is how do you get it out to kind of a broad array of districts across the state, not only the traditional public schools, but the charter schools? I mean, how do you make it available? And in the sense of the information that you present through the book that you have, do you have, is it on CD or is it on a course kind of a content that teachers can use? Or
The Northern Lights book itself is available primarily through its printed form, although we have made it available for students with different learning disabilities. For it's on Braille and other kinds of things as well. But the society in general is really trying to take a multifaceted approach to how we're trying to make our programs as widely accessible throughout the state as we can. And I think that's really kind of the difference about the way we look at the meaning of outreach in our educational programs. We have an active program, especially since the society benefits from the fact that we have historic sites that we can use as educational platforms throughout the state, that we can promote these workshops. And in terms of the subsidies that we do provide under this kind of appropriation, it's equal opportunity for charter schools, homeschools, private schools, public schools. And so we really do see the complete cross-section of educators coming in to participate in our our educational programs.
Maybe if I could just rephrase my question on, is there, do you have the capability or I hear the need is out there from some schools to have some electronic format, you know, so that they can, you know, pull that that information in and use it for a history class or a social studies or whatever. Are you doing that?
Okay. Yes. Thank you, Senator Stump. The society's kind of web presence and our delivery of electronic resources has really increased quite a bit, I'd say, especially over the past 5 years. The kinds of resources, we have multi-level curriculums, for example. We have an entire website unit on the forest fields and the falls, you know, talking about lumbering, milling, and the importance of rivers in state history. And so that's an example of one online curriculum. Some things that are more specifically resources that make it easy for teachers to get the society's collections in their classroom are things like our visual resources database, our photo and art database. They can keyword search anything that's a photograph that's in our collections, get that online, put it into their instruction. Other things, more specifically, we are trying to use our online resources to allow teachers to get the materials developed by other teachers. So we have a master teacher network where they can look at curriculum ideas, handouts, other things that have been developed by their peers that they can adapt and revise to make use in their classroom so that the educators we're working with aren't kind of working on islands. So technology is really becoming one of our critical delivery tools. And we're also experimenting with various forms of distance learning and other kinds of mediums to work with teachers and students.
And in certain areas, obviously, you have to have them kind of mesh with the standards. And now I don't think there's any standard, so to speak, for history, is there? I'll have to check with Senator Weaker, but... I mean, there are some content areas that you have to have some pretty.
Mr. Chair, yeah, that's fundamentally correct. And as serving on the committee, first as kind of a consultant and then as a voting member in the final sessions, it was really the place where the final version of the standards came together, is when the emphasis that had been placed on very clear and concise content standards across multiple areas of history were also embedded with the skills standards so that students would be required to learn content information, but then also the fundamental skills of a historian, which are to gather, analyze, and present information in a variety of different formats. So there is within the current document a holistic view of how to approach history education.
Okay. Senator Salzman.
Yes, briefly, Mr. Chair. You know, some of my favorite field trips, because my children attended Stillwater schools, was fourth grade and, you know, state history and exploring that many of these sites are in our own, you know, area. I wanted to just briefly discuss with you that in an education policy committee, just the other evening, we talked about staff development and how learning takes place also within peer groups within a school. And I think you touched on this briefly, and Senator Stump just brought up about, you know, online resources and an opportunity to maybe look at this as something that could be an online program as well, because it may be something where a group of teachers could take the course together and have sort of a discussion within their own school of how to implement this. Because I'm looking at this with the $200,000 this last reporting period, you had 400 teachers. Would the $200,000, would that be for approximately 400 teachers? That's about $500 per teacher. How might that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, this is a little different. This is actually a little bit more money. I think the last appropriation that we had in 06-07 was $150,000. And in the way we kind of approach this is that if we're working this kind of realm, we're going to be using less than 50% of that on staff and the other on a variety of kinds of resources of various breadth and depth. And I think the amount that we're asking for now is going to give us greater latitude to try and create a menu that goes from fairly traditional teacher trainings to online resources, and particularly this time around, supplemental curriculum development, which could be physical and online, to try and come up with the strategies that are going to best serve the teachers that we're trying to reach. And through these development of these Teaching American History grant proposals, one of the requirements are fairly in-depth surveys of teacher needs. And so we're getting every year a clearer perspective of kind of what are the barriers and opportunities to try and help teachers develop the best possible instruction in their classrooms.
Mm-hmm. Members, I just want to break in here before we hear from Mr. Keller. Former State Senator Gary DeCramer is here. Welcome. Served with Senator DeCramer a number of years ago, and I believe you're over at the University of Minnesota. And so, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Chairman, thank you. Just thought I'd see what's happening in good old 112. So, I think you're doing good work. Mr. Keller here is going to, I'm sure, convince the committee of this wonderful thing.
Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chairman, I really didn't have a lot additional to add. Mr. Hoagland summed it up fairly well, the needs that are out there and the work that we're doing across the state with teachers and students. So unless there are any additional questions about the society in general, I think Mr. Hoagland summed it up fairly well.
One of the governor's initiatives is to try to figure out a way to promote the online learning programs, and I think the work that you have, it could very easily kind of move right in that direction. Obviously, I mean, the content-based professional programs are I think, is what's needed, because that's kind of the direction that everything's going, you know, so. So, Senator Bonhoff, do you want to?
Sure.
If there's any other, is there any
Mr.
other?
Chair?
Senator Roebling.
Just a quick question. You know, there was a series in the Tribune a couple of weeks ago about teachers taking time from their classroom to attend workshops. And I know workshops are valuable, but I'm wondering if the Historical Society or even the Humanities Center, how often they have these workshops during regular school days so that we end up with substitutes in the classroom, some of which are contributing to the education of our children and some days of which are not productive. And so I'm just wondering, as we think about these programs for staff development, how they handle that so that we maybe don't take the teachers out of the classroom as often as we sometimes do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I think the Historical Society is in a position where we try to present as wide array of opportunities for the schools as possible. So we have summer institutes, we have Saturday programs, and we have school day programs. Of course, some of the things that we have to react to are things that are in the contracts that the school districts have with their teachers in terms of professional development days where there are scheduled release days. Some of the things that we are trying to do is, as you say, break away from our traditional models where on a Thursday at the History Center all day there will be a workshop about the Civil War. A lot of what we're experimenting with are more focused work, not with just individual teachers, but if we identify a school district that has set aside a professional development day, that we can come in and do a special program across teachers, usually grades 4-12, so that they get a more holistic sense of what they're doing across all the grade levels in the social studies where we have connections. So I think what you're identifying is an increasing trend where the schools are looking for at least some traditional programs, but for service providers like us or the Humanities Center to provide alternative formats. So we are moving that direction as those needs are defined, and we are really providing a multiple array of opportunities for schools.
One of the sheets that you handed out was this sheet that had little dots on it as to where the attendees for the academy, the History Academy, were or came from. And I guess I would just encourage you to continue to have as broad a brush of attendees from across the state as possible. There are quite a few rural Minnesota counties that didn't have anybody on here, but and I know that's an effort that you're interested in, and
we are very interested in more dots, Mr. Chair. And right. One of the things that this map doesn't specifically reference, though, is the kinds of programs, for example, that we would deliver for the Northwest Service Cooperative, which would be approximately four teacher training programs throughout the Northwestern Service Cooperative region. These are specifically just the workshops that were funded by the appropriation that we received in FY06-07. So this doesn't actually capture the full range of professional development that we've been delivering across the state. So next time we do our plotting, we'll great. Do more dotting.
Yeah, yes. We'd like to see more dots. Senator Bonhoeff renews her motion that Senate File 3436. Be recommended, be laid on the table and recommended to be included in the Omnibus Education Finance Bill. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same motion. Sound? the motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr.
All right,
Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. And
Senator
Dahl.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members.
Thank you very much.
Next, Senator Therese Ray, please. Senator Therese Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present this important bill. This Senate File 2964 intends to make changes to adult basic education policy, and our intent is to help the state ensure better access and service delivery to learners around the state. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this particular proposal is intended to really address some very critical challenges for the state of Minnesota. Challenges related to recruiting skilled workers to meet the demands of the market today. Minnesota faces significant challenges, for instance, by what we know is that by the year 2010, we will not have really enough highly skilled trained workers to replace the people that will be retiring from different places in Minnesota. And so our intent is to offer opportunities to increase opportunities for training for these particular workers. We also know that this is an issue that affects the entire state of Minnesota. And I have here a couple of people who will speak to the different changes that we're trying to move forward with this proposal. So if you could please introduce yourselves, I'll appreciate that.
Sure. I am Eric Nessa. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Literacy Council. I'm also here representing Literacy Minnesota, which is the professional organization for adult basic education in the state. As most of you know, ABE, adult basic education, consists of English as a second language, GED, citizenship, adult diploma, and many other adult literacy programs. And just about every community throughout the state has a program nearby them. We're essentially looking at three statutory changes in the language of the bill, Senate File 2964, and I'm just going to briefly touch on each of those three. First of all, I'm not sure if people are following around here. On line 2.6, the statutory language, we'd like to see a change in the statutory language to indicate that no more than 25% of the allocated funds for supplemental services goes to one provider. Through adult basic education supplemental services, the Department of Education can award grants to organizations to provide specific services for adult basic education providers statewide that are much more cost-effective for one organization to provide than any individual program to do so on their own. This is not a typical grant program that provides funds for local providers to enhance their own programs with additional or unique supplementary projects. The supplemental service providers generally fall within several main categories. Number one, professional development, which may mean teacher training, volunteer training. Number two, services to improve education delivery to high needs groups, such as those with learning disabilities or those who are hearing impaired. And lastly, services to improve service delivery and tracking of student services, which may mean things like technology, accountability, online classes, etc. Just some quick background on this. The current supplemental services cap is $100,000 per organization. Our proposal allowing 25% would mean about $205,000 per organization. The current limit makes it difficult for the Department of Education to obtain the level of services needed statewide when there are only a few providers who can provide these necessary services. And again, these services are generally provided by statewide organizations that have the capacity to get out to all different parts of the state. And just quickly, some of the groups that provide these services are my own organization, the Minnesota Literacy Council. Hamline University does teacher training. Robbinsdale Adult Basic Education does some work in physical and neurological disabilities. Communication Services for the Deaf works with the deaf community. The Learning Disabilities Association does learner assessment. The Minnesota Workforce Council Association does workforce education projects. And there are a number of smaller projects in southwest Minnesota working with the AccuPlacer test. And Minneapolis ABE is doing some work on databases as well.
Excuse me, Mr. Nesch. I just wanted to mention that in the governor's proposal, 15% of the total is what he's recommending. And so could you address how the difference, given there's not a total change in dollars in this bill, how that difference might affect certain organizations? How does that affect the overall distribution?
Certainly, and thank you for asking that. As you mentioned, the overall distribution is not to be changed. It's a 2% amount of the entire amount, which this year amounted to about $820,000, I believe. And like I said, initially it was a $100,000 cap. As the field has grown, as the field has improved and needed more professional development, training, accountability types of services, there was a greater need for getting out in the community and doing this work. And the cap remained at $100,000, meaning that no organization could get more than that. Generally speaking, the organizations that do this type of work are the statewide organizations. There's not a great number of them that are capable of doing this. And so what we're asking for through Literacy Minnesota is a larger increase, mainly because the increase that the governor is asking for would take it from $100,000 to $123,000, really not making much of a difference at all in terms of how much can get out to an organization to do this work. Our proposal brings it up to $200,000, making it a little easier for the department to make those decisions. And again, this is up to the commissioner. The department can decide whether they want to give out $200,000 to any organization. They still get to make that decision.
And Mr. Nesham, so is there a chance that there are particular organizations that because of this change will no longer get funding that would have gotten funding? And if so, do you have a sense of who that might be?
Yes. I have talked to the people at the Department of Education about this. The intent is not to take funding away from any individual organization. There are some smaller projects that are going on this year that are one-year projects that may not occur again next year. The intent, I don't think, is to give $200,000 to each of four organizations. I think there's one or two that would need that much, and there's a bevy of other organizations that would still have access to this to do innovative work. So my feeling is that, no, there wouldn't be anybody cut out.
Madam Chair and members, just to make sure that, you know, this is really giving the department the opportunity to kind of have this access that goes above that limit, but that doesn't necessarily, so it's up to the department to make the decision. So we are not limiting the department, but quite contrary, we're giving the department more room to contract beyond the 120, which is what they have right now. And this is particularly important for organizations that serve clients statewide. So what they do ultimately is their decision. We're just giving expanding these funds so that they, right now, the current limitation, it could be, could present a problem for organizations that serve a large number of clients.
Senator, the amount, since the funding formula was put into place, and I believe about in the year 2000, the amount of money going to adult basic education programs has essentially doubled, and this remained the same, meaning that that money has to be divvied out quite diversely at this point. And some of the work that needs to be done are things like working on statewide databases, running statewide hotlines, doing training, you know, doing all the volunteer training for the state. And so it makes it a little more difficult to spread if you're spreading that money out so thinly.
Thank you. And thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. And it looks like somebody from the department will want to testify after so we can get some of those questions answered. But, Mr. Nesheim, I just had one last question. Do you know specifically, could you tell us who those couple of larger organizations are that are serving on a statewide basis to just give us a sense on the committee of who we're talking about?
Yes, and again, I'll just the organizations that I mentioned are the current supplemental service providers, so it's my own agency.
And what would that
be? The Minnesota Literacy Council.
Thank you.
Hamline University, that does essentially does teacher training at this point. Robbinsdale Adult Basic Education, which has a project that does physical and neurological disabilities work. Communication Services for the Deaf, which works with the deaf community. Learning Disability Association, which does learner assessments throughout the state. The Minnesota Workforce Council Association, which is working on a workforce education project right now. Southwest Adult Basic Education, which is working on a year-long ACCUPLACER project.
Excuse me, Mr. Nesheim. So all of these ones that you're saying might get more than the cap?
No, in fact.
No, I'm asking which ones might be in that category.
Sure, I would say, and I I'm not the expert on this. I'm not from the department, but I believe that the groups that probably would get up to that cap would be my agency, the Minnesota Literacy Council, Hamline University, potentially the Learning Disabilities Association. My feeling is that it would only be two that would probably hit that cap.
Okay, thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
A little bit more here. If we could go on to the second change. The second statutory language change would be providing up to 3% growth factor to allow funding to be used for increasing contact hour reimbursement when growth in contact hour is less than 3%. And I believe that's line 227, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Line 2.27. Since the ABE formula was adapted in 2000, inflation has increased costs while the contact hour reimbursement rate has declined. So it is now less in modern day dollars than the 203 amount that we were receiving. Because of this decline, some programs have been forced to cut back even as demand for ESL services increase. The reimbursement rate currently does not cover the cost of providing services. The proposed policy would help increase the contact hour reimbursement rate without increasing the current adult basic education appropriations. It would do this by increasing funds by the lesser of 3% or the average growth in contact hours over the past 10 years, which has been approximately 9.7%. I'd add that in a slow economy, interest in our programs across the state tend to pick up dramatically with people looking to improve skills and get jobs. And if we don't see this growth factor this year, our programs without doubt will start to see waiting lists. Before I move on, is there questions? There's one last change that I'm
Just a comment, Mr. Nesheimen. I know I've raised these questions, but I bring them up because I know that in each of our communities there's such a great need for adult basic education. And you mentioned the Robbinsdale one, and I know it's not just Robbinsdale, but they're doing a tremendous job of reaching out into their own community to these adults who are immigrants and who do not speak the language and giving them the kind of training that they need. And so one of the concerns I have with the change in the cap is, will we then limit the ability for local communities to have access to these very important dollars, given that we're in a funding period where we're not increasing the dollars? And so I am concerned about that, and I'll let the committee decide, but I did want to raise that. Thank you.
Certainly. And then the last change that we're looking at is to change the statutory language to increase GED reimbursement to testing centers from $20 per test battery to $40 per test battery. And this is line 3.5. The GED test fees continue to raise, creating barriers for low-income students. Fees are now in the area of $100 per student, creating a significant barrier to many of the low-income students needing to take the test. Obtaining the GED is required for many entry-level jobs as well as for entry into many training programs. This change would allow funding already allocated to be utilized more effectively. The total of $125,000 per year appropriation is now not utilized at the $20 per student subsidy level. So we're asking that that be increased so that the amount allocated can actually be used.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Madam Chair, my name is Sherry Munyon, and I'm here representing Literacy Minnesota today. I do want to clarify that the funding that was discussed in terms of the 25% is not going to change any of the money going to the local ABE programs for investment in their students. This is a supplementary grant which helps train teachers, runs the hotlines, teaches the volunteer tutors, provides technology, etc. So that is a little bit separate. And then I think I did want to also just make a couple comments stressing the economic issue that's been raised here today and the impact on the state budget. We aren't asking for an increase, but we are talking about moving dollars around. Reallocation makes people nervous. But in general, if the 3% change isn't made, it probably leaves money on the table that was appropriated by the legislature, because without the policy language change we are recommending today, the districts probably won't use all of the money. So it allows all of the money to be spent. Where it probably is an economic issue is in internal budgets. If somebody's looking at the ABE program under current policy, can't spend all their money, there's money to take away and spend somewhere else. But we want to stress the importance of the adult basic education program, the role it plays in making people taxpayers and the benefit to the state. And I'll just give one quick statistic. In 2003, there were over 1,000 MFIP people, families, who were taken off of the welfare rolls because they had received their education and were able to become employed. That was a tax savings to the state of Minnesota of $4 million. That left $4 million in the general fund. What it cost to educate those students and put them in the workforce was $546,000, $500 per enrollee. So there's a direct benefit to the state by continuing to invest in the adult basic education programs.
Ms. Munyon, do you know what the average growth in state total contract hours over the past 10 years has been?
It's been about 9% is my understanding. The average growth over 10 years, 9%.
It's 9.7%.
Thank you.
And to add to the other issue on the 25% supplementary grants, we have been discussing this issue with the department. We've met with the commissioner a couple of times. I know she's talking internally about whether they can accept going from 15 to 25%. And she has expressed concern that if there were only four grants awarded at $205,000 each, smaller programs wouldn't get the money. But this is left totally in the hands of the commissioner. We aren't changing that. So they develop the criteria. They select the grantees.
If I could also add, Senator, with the supplemental services amount, the 25% we're talking about, there have been years when my agency runs the statewide hotline for adult basic education, which clearly affects and helps programs all over the state. There have been years when it's been very difficult for them to fund that. And we've had to look elsewhere for funding at certain times, mostly because we keep hitting this cap and they have to stop the funding for us. So it makes programming less consistent.
Mr. Nishim, I do understand that, and yet I think it's our role as the committee and as legislators to have the oversight to make certain that our local communities have access to the funds that they're going to need to respond to these changing times. And so that is why I remain concerned about that piece, and I would welcome comments from the committee. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe this is Mr. Nauman, just I'm trying to understand in this section 2, the change in the formula, does that not have a fiscal impact going forward?
Mr. Chair, and Madam Chair, Senator Hand, I don't believe so. I think the testimony has been, and we don't have a completed fiscal note on this, but if it would have a fiscal impact if the growth had been lower than 3%. I think the testimony here is that the growth is in excess of the 3%, so we're leaving money on the table, essentially. However, I am looking forward to reading the fiscal note, as I'm sure you are, to get the background on this to ensure that is, in fact, the case. Because the formula rewards the lesser of, and I think we've been assuming that we've been hitting that 3% growth each year. So essentially we could say it's the lesser of 3% or 300%, and we're getting the 3%, so it doesn't change anything. It may have some distributional issues that we talked about
right
earlier, but
okay.
Senator, if I may, the way I understand it, there are years when the field does not grow by 3%. There are years when the field has grown by in excess of 12 to 15%. And one of the concerns that we have is that because of the way the formula is structured, if programs essentially are serving beyond their capability, at a certain point they hit a wall where they can't serve any more people. And this year may be one of those years where programs just cannot grow anymore because they have hit the cap on the amount of funding that they have and amount of students they can serve. And one of our concerns is that if we don't see some kind of consistent growth in the funding amount, we will sort of spiral down at that point because of the way the formula is structured.
Mr. Nauman.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Hand, I think to that point, as we look at individual programs, and to the extent that this, what I'm about to say, is assumed in the forecast, there might be a fiscal impact. Oh. And what I'm thinking is that to the extent that an individual program is not growing at 3%, and that is assumed in the forecast, and that's the critical question, then there would be a cost.
Well, and Madam Chair,
Senator Hand,
and Mr. Nauman, I guess that's what I was thinking, that if you don't get 3% growth and currently the spending is somewhat less than that, then this would have a tendency to raise that. It may not be more than 3%, so it may be the allocation amount, so to speak, may not change, but the actual amount may change. Is that sort of the point you're making?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, I think you're thinking about it the right way. I think the critical question becomes how the Department of Education has forecasted individual programs and their growth year to year.
Okay.
So, Senator Torres-Ray, it sounds like there might be some things that need to get worked out with this bill.
Actually, Madam Chair and members of the committee, not necessarily worked out, but I think that the commissioner is ultimately responsible for working this out. We cannot really at this point through this formula and through this recommendation dictate. We're just offering a change that will give the commissioner and the staff really an opportunity to make a decision. So we are basically changing the formula to allow them to have more room in making the decision. But, you know, and especially with regard to your concern for the small programs, that's we're not limiting this for the smaller programs. It is just opening the room so that the programs that serve a greater number of students could access this funding. Again, you know, the funding is available to them, but there is a cap. And so we are not, with that cap, we are kind of closing the door to those programs that are growing. And because the need is now statewide, it presents kind of more of a challenge in terms of serving the population. So the department ultimately has to approve these programs, is what I'm saying. We don't approve from here. We're just giving, you know, we're just creating the formula so that the commissioner can have and the department could have really more room to make a decision as to what how to use these dollars.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Torres-Reid, just has the department, are they supportive of this change as well then?
We are right now in conversations about this. They are kind of in support, is my understanding, but they will be testifying right after us. So I think they are right now reviewing this recommendation, and I think they are going to come and speak about
Chair.
Their position right now.
If I could just say one more thing in regards to that, to
Mr. Nesheim,
the department, this the group Literacy Minnesota, which is a professional organization for literacy, is made up of programs all over the state. It's a very strong program and active. And the platform that we came up with were these three things this year. It was run by the entire organization throughout the field. The organization is, or the field is very supportive of these three pieces, meaning that Greater Minnesota programs, Metro programs, all heard about these, got to interact, got to offer their opinions, got to do some voting on this. So this is coming from the field. We have had discussions with the Department of Education about several of these topics. Some of them are in the governor's budget. Some of them are not. But again, just so you know, this is coming from the field.
And Mr. Nesheim, please don't interpret these comments as any lack of trust or faith in your organization, but rather an understanding that while we may trust the Commissioner of Education at this moment to make this decision, do we want to give the Commissioner ongoingly the opportunity to award grants to only three or four when that may not serve the best need? And so really, perhaps another approach might be to say, if there's money left on the table, that organizations can come back to request funding. But I don't think we need to decide that at this moment, and I look forward to hearing from the department.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Weber. I'm the Director of Government Relations at the Department of Education. I want to thank the testifiers. I think they have accurately portrayed some of the things the department's wrestling with right now with respect to the cap. We are carefully considering it. We were approached to do an amendment to our department policy bill, and we're looking at the impact. We also share some of the concerns that have been raised by you, Madam Chair, and other members of the committee about the impact to other programs that are currently receiving the Supplemental Education Services funds. It is accurate. It's at the commissioner's discretion, the way the language is reflected in the bill. I also would like to clarify for the record, it's been referred to a couple times as the governor's initiative, and it's actually not the governor's initiative. This is in the department's policy bill, which is Senate File 3001, and we do have the 15% increasing the cap from 100,000 to 15%, and we also have the GED provision too in our policy bill.
Thank you. It's all right.
That's okay.
Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, and I apologize for stepping out for a few minutes, but we don't have a fiscal note on this.
That is correct, Senator Stump.
Mr. Chair, we requested one on the 22nd. This one is a little bit more complicated, so I suspect the department's taking a little time to think about it.
Okay. And I do suspect the governor supports the Senate file that you mentioned.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify because
Thank
they
you.
Oftentimes get confused, Madam Chair.
Thank mm-hmm. you.
Yep.
So might I suggest that we lay this on the table rather than a move to approve it and include it, but just a motion to lay it on the table while we gather more information? Senator Stump, would you recommend doing that?
Madam Chair, I think so. I missed some of the testimony, but it would be nice to, we should have a fiscal note to see what actually comes back. Section 3 and obviously the discussion that was taking place when I came back in on the 3%.
And Senator Stump, the concern that I have raised is with regard to raising the cap to 25% rather than the 15%, and so we can fill you in more on that. Mr.
So
Nauman,
I
any
think,
comments?
It would be wise to get that fiscal note.
Madam Chair, members, I think I can encapsulate this quickly. It doesn't sound like there's going to be a fiscal cost associated with Section 1 of the bill, but more a distributional question and a question for members to think about in terms of if a commissioner so chose to distribute the money to four organizations, is the committee comfortable with that at this point? That's what the change would do, is allow the commissioner to make a distribution like that if he or she so chose. Section 2, as Senator Hand has pointed out, may have a fiscal impact. I don't think it's likely, and if there were, it would be small. In conversations in Senator Wieger's committee the other evening with Deputy Commissioner Anderson, she indicated that Section 3 would not have a cost because there is money still lying on the table that's being unspent. So I don't think that there would be a cost there. So it doesn't look like there's a large fiscal impact, but there might be distributional issues for the committee to consider.
Senator Stump.
Well, I think if we lay it on the table for consideration, I think we still have other. We're going to come back to it, so we'll have a fiscal note before we take final action. And so I think that's all right.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would like to ask, right now there is an agreement on the 15%, so because of timing, I think that it would be prudent to move it with the 15%, and then if there is a change and the recommendation and we come up with an agreement to move it to the 20%, then we will bring it back. If not, I would like to recommend that we just move it with the 15% and the recommendations, and then we will come back to address that increase to the 20%, to the 25%.
Madam Chair, it's at the
Mr. Nauman.
It's at the committee's discretion how they would like to handle this, but the 15% is alive in the administration's package that mm-hmm. the department just spoke of, and that bill is currently in Senator Wieger's committee. So it would be my anticipation that we would see that here as well. Maybe right. Senator Wieger wants to speak to that point.
Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you. Madam Chair, and procedurally, we just had the hearing, as you know, and it's mm-hmm. going to be back again before us next week. Ultimately, it will be before us. So
since, Madam Chair and members of the committee, since we have that, I would like to move this for a recommendation with the 15% so that it is, mm-hmm. in agreement
Torres
with
Ray,
the...
Yes. So Senator Torres-Ray moves that on line 2.6 we strike 25 and insert 15. And then Senator Torres Ray moves that Senate file.
Would you take that motion first?
Senate file 2964 be recommended to pass for possible inclusion in the education finance.
Senator Torres Ray, first let us vote on the First Amendment. So the amendment to, so Senator Torres Ray amends line 2.6 to strike 25, insert 15. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passed. Now, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So I would like to recommend that Senate File 2964 be recommended to pass for possible inclusion in the finance, in the education finance bill.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is passed. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Members.
Senator Rummel.
Changes the
legislation. Members, this is our last bill that we'll take up. And this is Senate File 3312.
Well, the department, I think, is approved. This is the reason it's.
Senator Rummel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill this morning. I have with me today representatives from the Minnesota Humanities Center. The Minnesota Humanities Center provides leadership, resources, and programs that advance the study of humanities and enhance the work of schools, colleges, and cultural organizations throughout the state. We hear so much these days about STEM and science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And as I recall, in a hearing not too long ago, Senator Han and myself were present listening to folks from P16. And Senator Han said more eloquently than I can probably say right now how important it is to consider the humanities and the arts. And we have here in Minnesota an organization that helps us amplify and strengthen the humanities presence in our state. And I will let the witnesses speak to this more succinctly. I have with me Mr. Daniel Romanstein from the Humanities Center.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
Before I do that, could I make an oral amendment?
Sure.
On line 1.6, it should read, $400,000 is appropriated and insert in fiscal year 2009 from the general fund, et cetera.
Okay. Senator Rummel moves in on 1.6 after appropriated, insert in FY 2009. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Robinson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Stanley Romanstein. I'm president of the Minnesota Humanities Center, and I appreciate your giving me a few moments to speak in support of Senate File 3312. Budget surpluses come and go with changes in the economy, but Minnesota's education standards, about which this committee has spoken from time to time this morning, remain in effect every year, no matter what the budget picture. Our expectations of Minnesota's students and of their teachers remain consistently high. We emphasize that we hold teachers accountable, and we expect their students to succeed. We scrutinize student test scores and issue school report cards for everyone in the public to look at. We hold schools and teachers accountable, and we are absolutely right to do so. In exchange, teachers are also right to hold us accountable. In good budget years, we equip the state's K-12 educators with the tools they need to help our students succeed. Through an annual appropriation to the Minnesota Humanities Center, this committee provides K-12 teachers with first-quality professional development on an incredibly wide range of topics, using primary documents like the Declaration of Independence in civics and social studies classrooms, teaching controversial texts like Mark Twain's Huck Finn in literature classes, the emergence of China as a world power. Subject matter that our state education standards require our students to teach, or our teachers to teach, and our students to know. In 2007, this committee, along with your counterparts in the House K-12 Education Finance Division, and the Pawlenty Administration, all recommended $800,000 in funding to support the Humanities Center's work with K-12 teachers. We were ready to use those funds to reach literally thousands of teachers all across the state through face-to-face seminars with our state's best scholars, but also through podcasts, through live streaming from our website, and through other media. We did that in order to make it possible for teachers throughout the state to access our resources, but also to allow teachers to stay in the classroom and not to have to go, to Senator Roebling's point a little bit earlier, not to have to leave the classroom. In the closing days of the 07 session, the legislature considered a wholly new education bill, one which contained absolutely no support for the Humanities Center's work with K-12 educators. We were a bit stunned, as were the teachers in schools all across the state with which we work. It's easy to say that in the budget ups and downs since 2003 that we have held K-12 education harmless, but I think that's not true. Supporting K-12 education and strengthening K-12 education involves more than adding to the per-pupil formula. You support and strengthen education in K-12 arenas when you equip teachers to do the job that the state has asked them to do. We ask them, we require them, we hold them accountable each and every year, regardless of the state of our budget. Our state's K-12 educators, in turn, hold the legislature accountable to provide necessary funding, and they look to us, to the Minnesota Humanities Center, to be there every year and to work with them as their partners. Quite simply, we cannot do that without consistent financial support from the Minnesota State Legislature. I would urge you to adopt Senate File 3312 to pass it. Our teachers and our students simply cannot wait another year in order to get about their jobs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rowenstein.
I have also with me Russ Market. Is that proper?
Yeah.
Russ Market from the Hmong Academy, who can speak to the value of this wonderful organization.
Okay. Give your name for the record. Is it
Russ Markert, M-A-R-K-E-R-T. And good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm here to lend anecdotal support to the request for funding in Senate File 3312. 3 years ago, I attended my first session of the Minnesota Humanities Center. It was a two-day workshop on urban geography. And in those 2 days, I had my eyes opened. I was teaching American history at an inner-city charter school called Ascension Academy, which is filled with at-risk students. And I was supposed to be teaching, as I say, American history. Very difficult in the year that I was taking this workshop, very difficult to get inner-city kids to engage with that type of content. What I found out at the workshop was the history and interrelationship of the history of Minnesota and the Twin Cities with its geography. It was a program primarily presented by a man, Mr. Lonergan, at McAllister, and it revolutionized the way that I taught history the next year. I led off with a six-week study of the history of the Twin Cities and its relationship to the Twin Cities geography, from settlement in the 1840s and 50s up through the business history of West Broadway, which my students knew on a day-to-day basis and could see through the mapping that we did of the ups and downs of business culture in on that avenue, how North Minneapolis developed. By developing themes in that study of local geography and local history, we were able to relate the entire history of the country as we went through the chronology to the development of the Twin Cities. And by doing such, we were able to get much greater engagement from my at-risk students than I would have been able to in presenting American history in a more conventional way. So I'm here to tell you the impact that the Humanities Center made on me as a classroom teacher, that it was very, very positive and, for me, very insightful.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Market.
And finally, we have with us from the Purpose Center for the Arts, Mr. Craig Farmer.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Craig Farmer, and I am an art history teacher at the Arts High School, which is part of the Purpose Center for Arts Education. I've been a teacher in the state for 11 years and 16 years overall. And no other institution provides the kind of content-rich seminars that directly impact my classroom teaching like the Minnesota Humanities Center. I have participated in 13 seminars through the center. Many of my lectures, EMAC lab experiences, and homework assignments reflect what I've learned in those seminars. Let me give you two examples. After taking part in an early American colonial seminar at the center, I created a homework assignment that asked my students to think about how their appreciation of a colonial furniture piece might change when they discovered the highboy was partly paid for by money earned in the Atlantic slave trade. After attending the Buford Delaney seminar, I authored an online lesson using the state-funded Arts Connect Ed website, which allowed my students to engage in a relatively unknown 20th century African-American artist. These are just two examples of how the Minnesota Humanities Center's teacher seminars have broadened the breadth of what my students learn in my classroom. This kind of breadth makes my students think more carefully about history, and particularly who has shaped the study of history in the past. In addition to benefiting from the content-rich nature of these seminars, I would also like to mention that the opportunity to hear teachers from across the state is invaluable. I will not soon forget how, when discussing the Gilded Age in an American history seminar, a teacher from the Iron Range informed us about how Andrew Carnegie is historically viewed in her area of the state. As a state senator on the Education Budget Committee, I am sure you have thought to yourself, what small investment could have the most impact on the Minnesota educational landscape? Well, today I'm giving you one of several answers, and that one of them is to restore the Minnesota Humanities Teacher Seminar funding. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Farmer.
Mr. Chair, before we go on, Senator, I did want Senator Scheid, before she left, wanted me to be sure to mention that she strongly supports this bill and the work of the Humanities Center. We are ready to take questions.
Okay, thank you. a couple of questions that I have, and then I want to talk a little bit about the language of the bill. One is, could you just take a minute and talk about the online learning options or opportunities, if you have any, and if there's programs that districts can access through the Humanities for that purpose?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer that. Through our website, we make teacher resources available to teachers around the state, but the thing that we were prepared to do with state funding that did not materialize in the last session was that we were prepared to podcast directly to teachers throughout the state. We were prepared to make it available for them to participate online, real-time, in our seminars so that they could stay in school classrooms and access things at their own time. We started hearing from teachers 2 years ago, particularly from the 22, 23-year-olds who are populating Minnesota's classrooms in record numbers, that they want professional development available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They want it online, on demand, and we were preparing to use state dollars to do that. We see it as the most effective way to reach teachers throughout the state and to give them the content that they want and that they need to teach to the state standards. So we've done some now, but we're ready to do much more.
And is that the money that would be appropriated in the bill, will that go for some of those activities?
Mr. Chairman, it would go directly for that.
Okay. They're working on it. Okay. All right. Any other questions? I'll just jump in on the language and what I'm trying to do, Senator Rummel, is to get some language put together that would be more in line with in line with the language that we used, or that was in Senate File 3436, which was the History Center. If And trying to, and I apologize, you don't have this language, but what I'd like to do is to try to spell out in a little more detail what would be the expectations of the Humanities Commission if they receive this money in terms of content-based professional development and curriculum development, et cetera. I think for the taxpayers and for the legislature, we'd like to have more, a little more in-depth language for accountability purposes and stuff. And I don't know if Mr. Nauman has come in with the language or not yet, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman, we've drafted something, but it's just been staff that's looked at this, and we're not sure if we're going the direction that you have in mind. But
all right.
I can read it if that's your pleasure.
Well, I think I see Senator Rummel was nodding her head in affirmity that affirmation that probably would be okay. You want to take a little first cut at it, or should we work on it some more?
It's your pleasure, and can read what we have
right.
at this point.
Why don't you go ahead.
Can, so essentially what this would do is put a period after line 1.7, and please don't write it down until you all agree
yeah.
that this makes sense.
Listen.
Strike lines 1.8 through 1.13 and gap on lines 1.4. And into that hole that we've created, it would read the following. The appropriation must be used for professional development, comma, staff development resources, and supplemental teaching materials, period. The Minnesota Humanities Center must report to the Department of Education by January 15th, 2009, on how these strategies have improved student opportunities to learn effectively without remediation and reduce gaps in student achievement.
And I think what I would add or ask staff to add would be that the programs would be content-based and they would be coordinated with the kind of the expectations of our standards.
We're perfectly amenable to the suggestion.
All right. Okay. We'll be sure to... fine-tune it and give you a copy, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions that members have? The other one that I have, and I didn't tell Mr. Nauman about this one, but it would be nice to have a report back to the legislature on exactly how that money was spent.
We could probably use a demonstration of the iPod, too.
Yeah, that probably would give us all a surprise. Sometimes I don't even know what some of those terms are. But I think the legislature, in its role of appropriating money and trying to be accountable to the taxpayers, would like to have a follow-up on where the money goes and maybe what it did. So... All right. On that, Senator Rummel, do you want to move?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move Senate File 3312 to be amended and then laid on the table for possible consideration in the omnibus bill.
Okay. On Senator Rummel's motion, any discussion or questions? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Rummel, and thank you for testifying. Next meeting for the K-12 Education Finance Committee will be next week on Tuesday. So I don't have the agenda yet, but well, committee is adjourned.